Hello, you're listening to On The Point, the News Collective's show, formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Alex Trabulsi.
I'm Grace Jenkins.
I'm Joshua Azizi.
And I'm Maddie Delplane. It's Friday, October 10th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today we'll be playing Alex Trebleseed's interview with Councillor Brenda Locke on the issue of policing in the city of Surrey.
We're also talking to Green Party candidate Scott Bernstein about drug policy and running against Adrian Dix in Vancouver, Kingsway.
I'm also going to be chatting about how voting will look like as British Columbia goes to the polls during a pandemic.
And to close, we'll have a discussion about a potential overdose prevention site outside the downtown East Side and more from this month's looming election.
But first, we'll take a listen to Alex's interview with Brenda Locke. Alex, can you give us a quick rundown on what you and Councillor Locke chatted about?
Sure, Josh. This week, BC Liberal Party leader Andrew Wilkinson announced that, if elected, his government would pause the city of Surrey's transition towards developing a municipal police force, as opposed to the RCMP, basically municipal force replacing the Mounties. Instead, Wilkinson promised that he'll hold a referendum on the issue.
That's quite the promise. But why did you want to talk to Brenda Locke about it?
Well, on one hand, not being a resident of Surrey had me wondering why this transition to a municipal force was such a contentious issue. And in addition to that, a municipal party taking a stance on what I thought to be a very localized issue caught my attention.
All right, should we play the interview now?
Yeah, let's do it. I had a lot of students from there, so I figured it's worth a thing to talk about, right?
Well, it's larger than just, I think, Surrey. So when we get into it, I guess we can talk about that a little bit too.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I suppose I'll start out with the question on the top of the mind that I had and some of my colleagues had, which was, why this idea of a municipal force or the transition to a municipal force is so contentious in the city.
Well, I think it's contentious in the city because of the way that Mayor McCallum handled it. I think that's been very clear from the get-go that it was hidden, it was kept with the mayor's office, it wasn't transparent. And so I think when any time, especially with local government, I used to be an MLA and cabinet minister in a previous job. And so I think any time when you're not being transparent with the public, they're going to get their spidey senses going, and they're going to wonder what the heck is going on, and they have good reason to. And I tell you, even for me as an elected representative here, I can't get the information I need to make a good decision. So there's a lot of distrust, and people are angry about that.
BC Liberals, obviously your former party when you were in the provincial legislature, their proposal to hold sort of a plebiscite on whether or not this transition should go ahead. Do you think would it have any effect on Surrey voters on a provincial level, or is it mostly just sort of a promise they're making, but it's not necessarily to gain any votes?
I think it's a commitment they're making to the residents. I mean, one of the things that, I appreciate where you're kind of coming from, and is it a provincial issue or is it a local issue? This could be considered a ballot question in Surrey. Absolutely. Will people go to the poll and vote because the BC Liberals have said they're going to do a referendum? Absolutely. There will be people that will do that. There's no doubt about it. The passion, I've lived in Surrey for 40 years, and I've lived in BC all my life, except for a couple of those dark years when I lived in Alberta. But anyway, I got back. So if you look, we don't usually protest like this in Surrey, or in the Lower Mainland. We're not usually that active when it comes to those kind of local issues. There are probably 7,000 lawn signs out around Surrey, all over the place, in Cloverdale, in South Surrey, in Fraser Heights, in Newton. Every town center in Surrey, you will see tons of lawn signs when you drive through residential areas. Like, who does that? And people are paying for their lawn signs. Like, I can tell you right now, all the Liberals, all the NDP, the Greens, and the Conservatives combined won't have half of the lawn signs that the RCMP group have. So, yeah, people are pretty motivated. They have signs on their cars. They have signs on the windows of their houses. And people are angry. So, yeah, that gets to, will it drive you to the poll to vote? Yes, it will. Just like in the last election, Surrey got out to vote at the polls because of the taking of the bridge tolls at the Portman. It'll be just, I think it'll be just like that.
Right. And I guess sort of building on that idea of a plebiscite, a referendum from a provincial government, is that a reasonable level of intervention that you could expect from the provincial government, or is there more or less that they should be able to do, I guess?
You know, I think where the Solicitor General failed Surrey was he didn't demand, and the provincial government does this with large sort of generational changes. The cabinet and the Solicitor General, who is ultimately responsible for public safety in the province of Vancouver, or province of British Columbia, he didn't demand proper consultation with the residents. If he would have demanded that, I think they would be in a different position, because he would have had a read and on the residents. But instead, he's decided to align himself and you know, by extension, Premier Horgan has aligned himself with a very, very unpopular mayor. And so I think from that perspective, if they would have done their due diligence, if the Solicitor General's due diligence would have been achieved by ensuring that they knew that the public say, or that the public consultation piece was done properly, they wouldn't be in this predicament.
Right.
Yeah, and they do that with other things. So, and I actually just did an inquiry with the minister responsible for municipal affairs and asked her about the ward system, because wards have come up in Surrey. And in order to do these large sort of big system changes, because local government is there at the pleasure of the provincial government, and there we answer to them, in fact, they have to know that that process has been justly done, and it hasn't been justly done. And quite frankly, the minister, the Solicitor General, was misled by the consultation process done by Surrey.
Right.
Shame on us for that, by the way. Shame on Surrey for that. No, seriously, it was terrible. Do you know, I'm going to tell you this because I think this is just shows you what a colossal screw-up this was. I had to, as a sitting elected councillor, I had to FOI my own city to get the raw data on the public consultation piece because they didn't want me to see it because they were giving false numbers.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's bad.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So I guess in that sense that the provincial government does have a responsibility to actually make sure that what's being put forward, what they're being expected to do, is actually what the people want. But also there's an expectation from the city to be truthful about why they're going forward with it and whether or not they should be going forward with it.
Right. Truth. That's a crazy concept, eh? But anyway, yeah, that kind of got missed along the way on the consultation piece. I think there's a bigger issue, though, when you're talking about public safety, because especially when you're looking at Metro Vancouver as a whole, I mean, you know, you can't have this patchwork. They've talked about regionalizing police forces in Metro Vancouver. They've talked a lot about different models that you know, they've talked about a different provincial policing model. So just sort of cherry picking and going, okay, Surrey is going to flip over and go to have their own little fiefdom of policing here. That's where the Solicitor General has to be very secure in what he's doing, because I can tell you right now, hiring police is not going to be easy. And Surrey, the Surrey Police Department, if it ever gets going, which believe me, I don't think it will, but we will be poaching officers from West Vancouver, because on a cop salary, you're not going to be living in that kind of real estate. We're going to be poaching from Vancouver. We could be poaching from Delta. So, you know, when you start pulling, destabilizing the policing throughout and the number of officers in different areas, that's a challenge. And you can Google any police department across Canada, but even North America, and you'll see hiring officers is not something that is easily done. They're now doing signing bonuses to get people to go into policing, because it's just, you know, they've had a really tough go of it, and people just don't want to sign up.
Right. So a very tedious and also sort of not secure situation that could happen.
You know, I think one of the things that, again, the city has failed, the mayor and the four people that are on his side of this argument have really failed. They look at public safety like it's some simplistic light switch you turn on, and in a couple of years, you bingo bango, you got a new police department. It's not that easy, and it's not simplistic at all. If you look at any of the other processes that have done this transition, it takes years. And it, you know, from my perspective, you're quite a bit younger, but, you know, there are three things. I said this to the mayor from the beginning. If we're going to go down this road, we better bring the public along with us, because at the end of the day, there are three things that are ultimately Canadian, and it's the moose, the beaver, and the Mountie. And you just don't mess with any of those without having a really good story to tell. Like, you just don't do that. And you know, fair enough, if having an independent police force is the right thing to do for the residents, we should be doing that. But, you know, let's answer a couple of questions. Can we afford it? Is it feasible? And what is it going to take to do there, to get there? But first of all, why are we doing it? Why are we doing it? I mean, when we look at the RCMP in Surrey, some of the best practices in policing are here. We have just under 850 officers in Surrey. Vancouver has over 1,400. So our populations are very close. And you start to look just at that. Vancouver is two per car, we're one per car. I mean, sometimes we're two per car, but we can do that in Surrey. And so policing in this great big geographical city is quite different than policing in Vancouver, where it's a more condensed city.
Right. Well, thank you for your time. It's very insightful.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Crackdown is coming to CITR. Starting August 30th, CITR will be airing the award-winning podcast about Vancouver's overdose crisis, told by drug user activists and supported by research. Crackdown is hosted by celebrated documentarian and longtime drug user Garth Mullins. Catch Crackdown every Friday morning at 8 a.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Instagram user number 69, identified. You are about to enter Bite Size. CITR and Discorder are using the Instagram interface to host local solo artists in a concert series on Instagram Live. Local solo artists include DJs, hip-hop artists, and experimental performers like Baby Blue, Devours, Lucid, Future Star, and DJ Paisley Eva. Performances will be streamed every Thursday at 6 p.m. Watch on CITR and Discorder's Instagram at CITR and Discorder. You are now entering Bite Size. Have fun.
And we're back. You're listening to On the Point by CITR 101.9 FM, where the News Collective bring you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
If you were listening earlier, you would have heard Alex Trabulsi's interview with Surrey City Councillor Brenda Locke about the BC Liberals' recent proposal to hold a referendum on the city's transition towards a municipal police force.
And next, we've got an interview with Scott Bernstein, who's running for the BC Greens in Vancouver Kingsway. Josh, can you tell us a bit about Bernstein and what he's running?
Sure, Grace. So Scott Bernstein is the Director of Policy at the Canadian Drug Policy Institute, and that's like an organization that seeks to advance legislation on drug use that is progressive, compassionate, and informed by both science and human rights. He's running for the BC Greens at Vancouver Kingsway, and he was largely motivated to run by what he sees as the province failing to take action on the overdose crisis.
That's interesting. Who's the current MLA in that riding?
That would be Adrian Dix, who's served as provincial health minister for the past 3 years and has held this seat since 2005. So it's kind of regarded as an NDP seat, but Bernstein is trying to challenge him on his record.
I mean, that's going to be quite the race. So let's listen to what the interview says and, you know, hear what Bernstein has to say.
And so can you tell our listeners just a little bit about why you wanted to run for office?
Yeah, sure. My big focus is drug policy, and I take a look around the province and we're experiencing a horrible public health crisis. We're actually involved in two public health crises. So, of course, we have the COVID crisis, but we also have an overdose crisis that's been going on for now about 5 years, attributable to a poisoned drug supply. I looked at the response of the government in dealing with the overdose crisis, and I really find it lacking. And I think there's a lot of things that we can do that would just be better interventions and help save lives and manage the overdose crisis better. So that was my largest motivation to run right now, is to raise awareness of drug policy issues and what we can do for them. Of course, I'm also interested in progressive change in other areas around things like climate change and building a sustainable economy and social services as well, which I'm also really, you know, eager to bring awareness to those issues.
So yeah, you're running in the riding of Vancouver Kingsway, and your BC NDP competitor is Adrian Dix, and you know he's been the health minister for the past 3 years. What are your thoughts on how Dix and his ministry have approached the overdose crisis?
My take on Adrian Dix is that he's largely been absent from conversations and approaches to the overdose crisis. And so when the NDP government came into power 3.5 years ago, they created a brand new ministry, the Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions, which was responsible for coordinating and organizing approaches to mental health, but also addiction and the overdose crisis. And so I think even though the health ministry funds things like treatment, harm reduction services, Adrian Dix has not been a very vocal supporter of dealing with the overdose crisis. He's been largely absent from conversations, and a lot of these things have been left with the Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions, which is actually the ministry that has the lowest funding. It has they receive about $10 million $1,000 a year, which is even less than the funding for the Premier's office. And so I think the ministry has been underfunded. Minister Judy Darcy is trying very hard to do things, but she just doesn't have the political power in the cabinet as other ministers do, including Adrian Dix. And I think to me, if the overdose crisis was as urgent and important as we know it is, and as the government says it is, the approach would be much different than we see today. We'd see full engagement of the Minister of Health, as well as also the ministers responsible for criminal justice in the province, the Solicitor General and the Attorney General. And we'd see, you know, approaches like decriminalization being fast-tracked, not kicked to Ottawa for, you know, delay.
And, like, what are some approaches that you believe are very important for addressing the overdose crisis that Adrian Dix hasn't as much as you'd like to see?
Yeah, so absolutely. So one of the first things we should be doing is decriminalizing simple possession of drugs. And so this is an idea. It's not a novel idea. It happens in other jurisdictions around the world, most notably in Portugal, which decriminalized all drugs in 2001. And there were really positive effects of that. They didn't see big increases in drug use. They actually saw harms of drug use decrease. They got people into care and services when they need it. And so I think we need to be urgently, particularly around COVID, because COVID made the overdose crisis worse. Because of COVID, we need to urgently decriminalize now. And so Dr. Bonnie Henry, who's, you know, the hero of COVID response, and we'll follow her off a cliff doing the things she says we should be doing for COVID, actually released a report in 2019 that called on the province to decriminalize, and it called on the province to do that unilaterally with amendments to the Police Act or other things that would change how drug crimes are enforced, and so basically like reduce police enforcement of drug possession. That was ignored. That report was just, you know, kiboshed immediately by the government that said, we're not going to do that. And we've sort of been in this stasis now for over a year where we have the situation where Premier Horgan says, I really want to decriminalize, but then says, it's not my responsibility to do it. It's Ottawa's. And Ottawa says, you know, the prime minister says, no, we're not going to decriminalize. So we're stuck. And I think what we need to do is we need to figure out how to decriminalize as soon as possible. And what decriminalization does is it's important because it allows us to really treat substance use as a health issue where people have problematic relationship to substances. It reduces stigma, and stigma and discrimination create really terrible barriers to accessing things like treatment or safe supply or other medical services that people who use drugs need. And so decriminalization would help. There's really no downside to it. We should be doing it immediately, and we shouldn't be imposing things like new fines or forced treatment or drug courts on people. It just should be a stand down of the police. So that's the first thing I think we should do. The second thing I think we should do is we have a program of safe supply. We've now, as a province, created the ability for registered nurses to prescribe safe supply. And so safe supply is basically just pharmaceutical alternatives to drugs that people are purchasing through the unregulated market and which could be tainted with all kinds of chemicals and poisons and, you know, powerful opioids and different things that people aren't looking for. And so a pharmaceutical alternative is safer because people know what they're getting. They know the potency of it, and they're getting it through a doctor and a pharmacist. And so we have programs of safe supply in place now, but not nearly up to scale of what it needs to be. And so we need to be listening to drug users as consumers to find out what drugs they want to receive through safe supply. We should figure out how we provide them with those drugs in a safe a safe and responsible way, and ultimately make sure that it's accessible to anybody who needs it across the province, whether you live in Vancouver, downtown East Side, or whether you live in a rural community up in northern BC. You should be able to access a safe supply of drugs when you need it. So the third thing I would suggest to respond to the overdose crisis is we really need to be thinking about harm reduction again and scaling it up. And so we need supervised consumption services. We need naloxone. We need needle syringe programs. All of these things need to be at scale across the province and operating at a level that is accessible to people who use drugs. And so what happened with COVID was a lot of these services that had been in place and were saving lives ended up getting shut down, and people were told to, you know, stay home. And what we've seen now is a dramatic increase in overdose deaths in the province. And so for the last 4 months, we've had record-setting number of deaths, the highest number of deaths we've ever had.
Something I did want to ask about earlier was the topic of safe supply, because I know that the government did introduce a safe supply program back in March, just in light of the pandemic and all. And of course, there was Bonnie Henry's recent announcement that nurses could prescribe non-tainted drugs as well. But as you were saying earlier, you know, it's kind of on more of a small scale. How do you propose that the government should approach the issue of safe supply differently?
Largely what has happened is, you know, I mean, we're in a context where doctors were told, you know, after a period of overprescribing of opioids, which that situation was never as bad in Canada as it was in the U.S., but it was part of the reason that people now have dependence on opioids in a high number is opioids for a period were overprescribed. And so doctors were very sternly told, you know, don't do this, don't prescribe opioids unless absolutely necessary and you know, in certain conditions. And so safe supply is now a big reversal of that. And physicians and pharmacists are quite wary of doing this. And so I think, and then the other factor that plays into it is this stigma and discrimination against drug users generally, where often physicians or pharmacists look down upon drug users and don't really treat them medically as the way they should be. And so I think, you know, what we could be doing is instead of leaving it as a sort of a voluntary program where physicians can, you know, decide to prescribe safe supply or not, and many are choosing not to, the province can actually take a more proactive role in directing the colleges of physicians and pharmacists to mandate that doctors take part in this program. Like, they need to be trained, they need to deliver it, and they have to do it. If somebody shows up in your office and says, I want to get a safe supply of opioids or benzodiazepines or stimulants, the doctor shouldn't say, no, I'm not doing that. They should say, okay, I'll help you. And that's, you know, it's sort of the situation if you went into your doctor and said, I have a skin rash, can you please prescribe something? And the doctor saying, no, I'd rather not. You know, I think that we'd find that offensive and unacceptable in other situations. And we should find it the same way when a person is going to a doctor and seeking medical care. We can't allow them to be turned away because of stigma or discrimination or just a doctor that just doesn't want to get involved in this program.
And kind of moving on to one of the big other planks that you were talking about there with the decriminalization, the BCNDP did release their platform a few days ago, and they did make a commitment to establish decriminalization, like either federally or what their words were made in BC option. Like, are you kind of skeptical about that promise? Or because it kind of seems like something that you're talking about as well, because they're saying that they do want to decriminalize provincially. But what are your kind of thoughts on that promise?
I find their language to be quite vague and wishy-washy and more of business as usual, because nothing particularly has changed from other things they've said about decriminalization. So again, you know, Premier Horgan said, yes, I'd like to decriminalize. It's not our jurisdiction to do it. So we're going to go, you know, talk to Ottawa about it. And so basically there are different mechanisms where the province can decriminalize. So the first one is we can ask the Minister of Health in Ottawa to issue an exemption for the whole province to the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. And so that's the first thing we should be doing. We have indications that the Minister of Health would do that in Ottawa. They would be open to doing that for our province. And so we should be strongly advocating that the federal government issues one of these exemptions. And at the same time, what we should be doing is the thing that the BC government said they weren't interested in doing, which is implementing Dr. Henry's recommendations about amending the Police Act. And so that's something that we could do in BC. And basically what it says is that we are deprioritizing enforcement of simple drug possession. And so you as a police department cannot spend resources, human or money, monetary resources on enforcement. And so those are two things we could do. Those are, I think those are very specific answers as opposed to the NDP's sort of, you know, we're talking to Ottawa about something, which could also mean we're just waiting for Ottawa to, you know, come out in favor of decriminalization for the whole country. It doesn't, and then a made in BC solution. I'm just not sure what that means. You know, we have specific mechanisms. There's no reason to be vague at this point. And I think we shouldn't be. And so I think, again, I want to reiterate, like, there's a lot of discussion of, like, oh, you know, our fear, like, oh, we can't decriminalize because, you know, chaos. And, you know, we must put in place all kinds of services and things before we can decriminalize. And so what we know is that criminalizing people who use drugs, it just makes their life worse. It makes the situation worse. It harms public health, harms human rights. There is no benefit. We know it doesn't work. It doesn't reduce anybody's drug use or the availability of drugs. And so I think at a simple thing we should do is just stand down the police. We should stop criminalizing people. Now, if we do that, we'll save a lot of money. We'll save policing costs. We'll save criminal justice costs through the court system. And we can choose as a society how to spend that money. We could say we'd like to put more treatment options available. We'd like to scale up harm reduction. We'd like to scale up education and prevention. Like, all of these things are on the table, but decriminalization shouldn't be held hostage to us putting in some program first, because people's lives are suffering and people are dying. And so we need urgent action quickly.
The BC Liberals have also been very critical of the NDP's approach to the overdose crisis. They've mostly kind of stressed talking about, like, recovery and prevention as kind of something that they really want to see expanded. Kind of, what are your thoughts to that approach of the issue, just like really emphasizing things like recovery?
Well, I think recovery is fine. It's, you know, like, I believe, first of all, recovery is sort of a vague term in itself. And often what people mean when they say recovery is abstinence. And recovery is actually much more complex than that. And I think, you know, recovery is actually a very personal term where, you know, you may get to a point where, like, I'm continuing to use drugs, but it's not affecting my life in such a harmful way anymore. And that's recovery. Or it could be that I am abstinent, or it could be that I'm in some other situation, but it's a very personally defined term that I think, you know, it sort of necessitates a bit more clarity. But I feel like when people decide I no longer want to take drugs or I want to reduce my drug use, that's great. And I fully support that. And I think that person, when they're ready and able, should have a program of treatment in place that they can access. But the challenge is, though, that often people are not at that space. We hope they will be someday, but we're not going to let them die in the meantime. And so that means that we really need to focus on harm reduction. And so it's harm reduction around policy, which is decriminalization, but it's also harm reduction around just providing them safe spaces to use drugs where they won't overdose, or if they do have an overdose incident, it gets reversed through oxygen or through naloxone. And so that's a supervised consumption site or an overdose prevention site. And so I think, you know, treatment is fine. It's one pillar that we should be thinking about. There are other pillars of addressing the overdose crisis that have often, you know, not been put in scale, up to scale, and if not been treated the same. And so I think, you know, we should have all options on the table. We need a very as broad of a toolbox as possible to address the overdose crisis.
And yeah, that's all I got. Thank you so much for this. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye. Take care. Bye. Take care.
Hi, this is Dick Valentine from Electric Six. You're listening to CITR 101.9, University of British Columbia. When a problem needs a problem solver, guess who gets the call? Me and Saul. You're tuned in with a black revolver. Guess who dropped the ball? The writing's on the wall. The president's a copper lady, long since a dream. From New York to Los Angeles and all points in between. Burning 50 million megawatts of gasoline.
I got a stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder, and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
Who we view as the most authoritative and electable is rooted in systems of oppression.
There are so many inequities around having our experts in our community speak about our work.
Obviously, there are several facets to this strangely homogenous nature of the electoral system.
And to be left out of conversations, it only exemplifies that loss of self-esteem.
Check out CITR's live panel podcast, Conversations, hosted by our Indigenous, Accessibility, and Gender Empowerment collectives. Subscribe to Conversations, available now on iTunes.
We're back again. You're listening to On The Point, CITR 101.9 FM's local current affairs program, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
We've already talked so much about the provincial election on this show, but how exactly are you supposed to vote and make your voice heard? Grace decided to do some digging for us.
Thanks, Alex. This will be the first early election in BC since 1986, and it's important that you vote in it. But how do you go about voting in British Columbia? I'm an American, and I only have the vaguest idea of how voting works in Canada, so I figured I'd find out.
Awesome. So how do you register to vote?
So in order to vote, you need to be registered. Most Canadians who are eligible to vote are already registered in the National Register of Electors, which is wild to me if you know anything about voter registration in America. To check if you're registered at your current address, use the online voter registration service. After an election has been called, you can also register at your local Elections Canada office or at your polling place when you go to vote.
Right, that's how you register, but what about voting itself?
Great question. When an election has been called, there are several ways to vote. On election day, at your advance poll, at a local Elections Canada office, or by mail. Advance polls are held on the 10th, 9th, 8th, and 7th days before election day. You can find the date and address of yours online, on your voter information card, or by calling Elections Canada. You can vote at any Elections Canada office in the province until the 6th day before election day. You need to complete an application at their office. Once your application is accepted, you'll get a special ballot voting kit, and then you can vote on the spot. Or you can come back to the office to submit your vote later.
Voting by mail is obviously a big concern right now during the pandemic. How do you do that?
To vote by mail, you need to complete an application after an election is called. After you fill that out, you can send it in along with proof of your identity and address, by fax, mail, or in person. Once it's accepted, you'll be mailed a special ballot voting kit, which has instructions on how to mark your ballot and mail it in. This probably doesn't need to be said, but you can only vote once in an election. Don't commit voter fraud, kids. Now that we've solved the mystery of how to vote in BC, I hope that I've been helpful. Now, if you're eligible, get out there and vote.
Thanks, Grace. The provincial election may be all we've talked about so far, but most of the issues our interviewees spoke about are also being talked about in the Vancouver City Hall as well. For example, the overdose crisis. Maddie has more about that.
Next week, city councilors will vote on approving a permanent overdose prevention site in Yaletown. If it's approved, Rain City Housing could lease a space on the corner of Seymour Street as early as November 1st. It would be Vancouver's first permanent overdose prevention site outside of the downtown east side. Rain City currently does overdose prevention at St. Paul's Hospital, but is looking to find a more permanent space. If approved, the location will offer many services to residents of the West End and Granville corridor. These include supervised injection services, naloxone training, access to harm reduction supplies, and referrals to other mental health services. A council report says that the site is necessary because of the increasing number of overdoses during the pandemic. Some Yaletown residents are saying that the site will increase crime in the neighborhood, but the report says that people experiencing homelessness who use drugs are increasingly targeted for abuse, and that's exactly why the safe indoor space, like Rain City's location, are needed. Joshua Azizi and I will be covering more on this story on next week's show.
I mean, it's a huge issue, obviously, and, you know, homelessness, the overdose crisis, they've been huge provincially too. So I wanted to sort of touch on this and just open it up to a discussion on how the parties are treating, you know, this issue and like their entire platform as we look forward to next week's leaders debate. So on the topic of, you know, overdoses, homelessness, crime, all of those sort of interlinked issues, the Liberals want to, only the NDP has announced their platform so far. The Liberals and Greens are expected to do so later this week. So the Liberals want to integrate mental health in the police to create like an integrated policing unit. The Greens want to obviously decriminalize drug possession and, you know, expand safe supply, and the NDP, you know, their platform promises safe supply, which they actually promised earlier, even before the election, but that hasn't really gone on off the ground yet. So let's talk about the NDP platform then. So the NDP is promising $1,000 to families earning below $125,000, and $500 to single people, which, you know, shows their priorities, I guess. And then there's there's free bus rides for kids under 12. They're banning single-use plastics. There's no provincial service taxes on e-bikes. Those are like the main standouts of their platform. I mean, in terms of the Liberal platform, you know, talking about the PST, Andrew Wilkinson said he'd suspend the PST for a whole year. That didn't seem to go over too well, as we talked about in last week's show. And there were promises around introducing a private competitor to ICBC, which was actually one of the Liberals' biggest sort of sticking points. The reason some people say they lost the last election was because of ICBC and all of the things that they've done to it over their like 20-year tenure in BC government. So that was an interesting promise. I wonder whether voters will forget that. And obviously, there was this huge dog whistle that Wilkinson put in about homelessness, where he said he wanted to stop panhandling and make it illegal and all sorts of things like that, which I honestly don't think it's going to work out for him, but
yikes,
whatever. And let's talk about the Greens. So Sonia Furstenau, who's the very new Green leader, she announced $500 million in support for low-income renters, which would be means-tested. So I have no idea if that would ever work out. And $500 for each parent for childcare. They haven't announced too much else yet because, as I said, their platform hasn't been announced, but that's what they've announced so far. So I wanted to open it up to everyone. We've talked about all these issues and, you know, the NDP's platform. What do you think will be the big issue during next week's leaders' debate?
Well, I think that obviously the pandemic is going to be something that pops in, and just the idea of holding a snap election at this time would probably be something that will be brought up. I mean, we've seen that before with advertisements that the BC Liberals have put out. But also, I think generally they just, the province on an issue basis just has been unable to escape or deal with drug overdose prevention. And I think that's definitely going to be heightened considering the state that, you know, there's a big demand on healthcare right now, especially for people who are suffering from COVID. And I wonder if there's a chance that people may be falling through the cracks, especially people who have addictions.
Isa, let's hear from you. You haven't talked too much in the script.
Stop
so far.
Calling me so... out. My interest is on like housing and what the parties are like, or the leaders are going to be promising on that front. So I'm a bit curious. I'm going to turn the question to you guys, what you guys think, like judging from what we've seen from the BC Liberals and the NDP especially.
Unless I'm missing things in their policies, I don't really see much like concrete stuff about housing. I mean, the NDP have a track record in government that we can look at and say, okay, it can be expected that they're just going to continue on with like picking up these properties or making more temporary housing. But beyond that, it's not much to work with, unless I'm missing something.
I mean, I like, maybe I'm missing something too, but I remember like reading about the platform being announced and I didn't see much written about like building more like low-income housing or building more rental units. What I saw a lot of was like kind of assistance to current renters, so like the 400 a year renters rebate or the rent freeze that they've announced, which was definitely one of the more surprising planks of the platform in my opinion. Also the COVID-19 pandemic relief, so they'll give everyone some money basically to help them manage through the pandemic. So yeah, kind of seems like a lot of more assistance to current renters than maybe like building more spots.
As Josh mentioned, they haven't really done anything concrete. I don't know. Sonia Fostenau said she would also, you know, give the means tested $500 million grant to low income renters. Apart from that, I don't think there's too many commitments to building new housing, you know, acquiring new land, anything like that. So I have no idea how that's going to shake out.
It's sort of like the platform right now around homelessness, especially with COVID, is seems more of a, we're going to stop it from getting worse. And then once it doesn't get worse, we'll work from there. Which is a very, it's not a very bright plank, but it's a plank nonetheless, I suppose. Also, unless someone else has something to say about housing before I just go on a complete tangent here, but... And sort of this policing thing, as you know, mentioned earlier with my interview with Brenda Locke, this issue of policing in Surrey, but also generally in the Lower Mainland, and their integration with mental health, with mental health professionals, as was suggested by the Liberals. I like that idea, but is it also that, would that integration also make a requirement that they respond to those calls and they're the first people to respond to those calls? Or will we just be in a case where they have the professionals but they're not necessarily the units that are actually responding to these calls? Just a concern.
I think it's very much an issue that seems simple on first glance, because I think it sort of seems like a slam dunk to include mental health professionals along with the cops when they're responding to, let's say, a call of distress or something. But integrating it within the institution of policing is very problematic to me, because the very idea that police officers should be there in that such a situation screams sort of not exactly a caring attitude is what I get out of that. Because, yes, exactly, because if you're truly dealing with a mental health issue, if you're dealing with, let's say, an overdose, or let's say, you know, someone's passed out or something like that, I wouldn't want to see sirens and a police car there. If there was a commitment to, in fact, if they wanted to go all the way and, you know, hashtag defund the police and make it mental health only, then my ears would be perked. But right now I'm just seeing an extension of the policing institution, right, which isn't going to do it for me.
Can I add on that front? I think I agree with Akshay in that it can prove to be very problematic down the line, especially if someone's having an episode, like they should be dealing with like a health professional versus a police person who is probably gonna put them in cuffs and whatnot. And I like personally know someone in my life that's had to go through that experience of being like put into cuffs, even though like they were just emotionally having like going through a difficult time. Yeah, anyone else?
It kind of reminds me just like back in June when a lot of people were put on the kind of pushing for defunding the police, kind of, I mean, it was a thing in Vancouver, but also throughout all of North America, that one of the talking points that came out of that was for mental health care, that the police kind of have a really big role in that topic and that there should be kind of more separated resources when it comes to dealing with mental health. And obviously everyone kind of agrees that there needs to be mental health care in the province. And it kind of seems like the Liberals are proposing something that is very kind of the opposite of what that movement was pushing for back in June, where it's still tied in with police. And I think what a lot of, and I think that approach to it gets a lot of criticism.
We have like less than a minute. How's this going to go? Do you want me to do the outro or does anyone else have anything else to add?
I think we won't have time for the outro. I don't want to risk it. So let's just join another call. We'll do the outro and then we'll debate.
Okay. Oh, we'll see if the call extends. Because it might. But if it just kicks us out.
Okay, let me go.
It might magically extend.
There it is.
So that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. Oh my god. Okay, let's do this again.
No.
So that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been On the Point by CITR News. We're here every Friday at 10 a.m. bring you local news, and stay tuned for more amazing programming.